You are listening to Around Comics Season 2, Episode 9 with Brent Schoonover and Mitch Gerrits. Yeah, boy! Folks, it's Al, and you're listening to Around Comics, and this episode has nothing to do with Before Watchmen. Yeah, I know. Braxton and I have been doing the Before Watchmen thing, and it's been a lot, and it's pretty much all we've been doing, and I know that some of you are getting a little tired of it. So we're going to change things up starting right now. This episode is me and Brent Schoonover and Mitch Gerrits. If you're not familiar with those two dudes, they are both comic book artists, and they're both from Minnesota. So, other than that, you'll find out all sorts of things about them as the conversation kicks off. Before we get to that, though, I do want to mention that this episode is sponsored by Discount Comic Book Service.
Citizens of Earth, listen carefully to my words. The words of greatness, the words of doom! I am the supreme ruler of the sovereign nation of Latveria. Here, my people need not your foolish children's books for entertainment. Comic books filled with moronic tales of spandex-clad heroes. I would never allow their minds to be polluted with such drivel. But if I did, I would suggest, nay, I would command they patronize this discount comic book service. How idiotic this company must be to offer such low prices. 35 to 75% off? The fools! They insult Doom with their utter lack of business acumen. 50% off hardcovers and DC's new 52 titles? Marvel Now pre-orders up to 75% off? You make it all too easy, DCB service. Even a dolt like Reed Richards and his band of misfits could defeat the likes of you. Go now, you cretins, I command you. Save your pennies and fill your minds with tales of fantasy and heroes. It will only soften them and make it that much easier for Doom to enslave mankind and take his rightful place as ruler of the world!
Holy shit. What the hell is that? Is he using, like, equipment from the 1950s? Like,
No, seriously, the noises coming out of here could have been used for, like, a trailer for a horror movie.
Right?
You just need a little kid starting, like, a nursery rhyme.
Mitch, are you alive?
Mitch?
Do-do-do-do. Yeah, can you hear me at all?
Yes.
Yeah.
Are you, like, soldering wires into your computer to...
I'm using the Apple headset currently. I don't know if it's...
Okay, now you sound good.
Yeah, now it sounds okay, but getting to... That was the weirdest...
It sounded like Ike Taylor was putting in the cord and was really mad. Just beating the crap out of it. Well, I think we sound good now.
Let me hear you, Mitch.
4 score and 7 years ago...
Yeah, it sounds good now. All right.
I was going to blame it all on the Kiss Motley Crue concert that's playing about 3 blocks from my house right now.
What? Like, actual?
Yeah. They're, we live, well, you know, you've been to my house, but, like, we're right next to the state fairground.
Yeah.
And tonight is a Motley Crue and Kiss concert at the fair.
That's awesome. I wish I was there. I
kind of was like, man, I could really just go get drunk and have some fun at that thing tonight. But I decided to hang out with my friends and catch up. So
I
saw Mitch last night. Was that last night?
Two nights ago.
So I saw Crew, I think, three times. I've seen Motley Crue.
Yeah.
And I'm not like a huge Motley Crue fan, first of all. I just, for whatever, like, I had friends that were big, and they were good. It was just like good shows. Like, they are some of the funnest concerts I've ever been to.
I went to a show at Alpine Valley, and you know where that is.
Oh, yeah.
When we were walking out, it was like the sun, like my freshman year in college. They were giving out stacks, like as many as you wanted, to a Anthrax, Motley Crue, Megadeth tour, concert.
Really?
And, I mean, they're like, you want 70 of these? Go right ahead, take them. And so, like, so we just grabbed these stacks of them. And then, like, I was like, what? I didn't think of it. But all of a sudden, like, the week of, like, everybody's like, we should just go to that concert for free, because what else are you going to do in small town Illinois? So we drove to the concert. And it was just, I mean, Alpine Valley, what, 100,000 people? I don't even
know. Oh, yeah. I'm sure. Well, probably. That's a pretty big venue.
People, probably. And there, I would say there was maybe 3,000. We stayed for a little bit. This is like Motley Crue had a female drummer for some reason. And,
what?
It was not a great show, but I don't know. I was young, went with a bunch of friends, and just the music wasn't even a big deal. But
I saw them on like Theater of Pain and Dr. Feelgood tours. Was like when they were still huge, and it was insane. Like, they were crazy shows back then. But I haven't even been to a concert. And
Mitch, you followed them like the whole Dr. Feelgood tour, right?
I never had that phase of music in my life. I mean, I like them good enough, but I never had that, like, where I actually put in a Motley Crue album and listened to it.
I grew up in the 80s. Like, high school was, you know, my high school years were, like, 84 to 88. So, I mean, it was, you know.
At that point.
Yeah. I mean, Motley Crue and Van Halen and all that stuff, but. Anyway, well, I think we've already started this episode. I should probably introduce you guys and tell everybody welcome to Around Comics. If you're not familiar with who I'm talking to, because we haven't said who it is, I am joined today by two fantastic comic book artists and other type of artists too, but you may know them as comic book artists. Brent Schoonover.
Yep. Hello.
And Mitch Gerrits.
Nailed it.
All right. Well, I asked Brent beforehand because I had no idea how to actually pronounce it. Welcome, guys. Welcome to Around Comics.
Hey, thanks for having us.
First question, what was your first concert that you ever went to?
Mitch, you go first. I have to remember this.
Well, it's a difficult question, because you can either say concert as in like a big arena type thing, or like show. The first show I was ever at was this little like punk ska band called Animal Chin. The first concert I was ever at was an Everclear and Redman show.
Nice.
Nice. Yeah, I remember going to see my brother's band Nosotros at Beloit College in southern Wisconsin, and that was my first like little show. But then I feel like it was the Rockford Metro Center. Who did I see? Damn it, I think Rancid opened up for somebody. It was Bad Religion? I don't remember. But and then I remember seeing Bad Religion again with, like, Less Than Jake or something. I feel like I've seen them a couple times. So that was probably my first show.
Not bad. I think I might have you guys beat a little bit. This is kind of insane. I was probably 12 or 13 years old. I'm in Florida, visiting family in Florida, and my mom was at the time sort of a radio show addict. Like, she would just try and win anything on any radio station she was listening to. If there was a contest, she would call it, and she was good at it. Like, she had some sort of system. I don't know how she did, but she won all sorts of crazy shit. Well, she won tickets to the Michael Jackson Victory Tour.
Wow.
And at the Gator Bowl Stadium in Jacksonville, Florida, me and my sister went,
And that was my first concert, was Michael Jackson on the Victory Tour with the Jackson 5 and all that. It was
wow. Pretty,
and then believe it or not, my second concert later that year was Michael Jackson. No, it was the same concert, but here in Illinois. She had won tickets again on a radio show, and that was my second concert, was Michael Jackson. So
I ended up, I was in a program called Upward Bound in my high school years. It was sort of like to kind of help you prepare for college. And every year, what you do is you go to a 3 weeks or 4 weeks or something off during your summertime. You would stay on campus of a college. You would take some kind of college prep courses. And if you stayed all 4 weeks and you did good, you got to go on a trip. And we ended up going to Washington, D.C. And one of the parts of the trip, they weren't telling us, but they told us we were going to a concert that day. We're like, oh, I wonder who it's going to be. And we end up driving the bus, and we go to BET Television, and it was a Sade concert.
Nice.
So we ended up watching... We sat in the front row of a whole like host of VJ segments. Like we'd just be in the background as they like kicked off videos and stuff. And then at the end of like 2 hours of them doing all of this, like, you know, here's a Ghetto Boys video, you know. And then they brought out Sade for like 5 songs, and I had no clue who she. Yeah, Smooth Operator, and that was the only one I knew, and like the rest of it, but like. They really were like, you need to be animated, you know, this is going to be on TV. And it was hilarious. And I'm like, I have no idea who this lady is. But then finally she played Smooth Operator, and it's like, I'm supposed to be like slow jamming to it. Like, one of the most awkward moments of my life.
Get your lighter out and just do that back and forth, you know.
Exactly.
To Smooth it.
When I'm 15 years old,
I used to go to a lot of concerts when I was younger, you know, but I've had some weird experience with concerts too, like the Michael Jackson thing, and then my wife actually had won tickets at her work or something.
Paid for a ticket?
Yes, I have. Yeah, I was trying to remember what my first paid concert was that I bought tickets to. It was probably like, oh God, I don't remember. I think it might have been Stars and Guitars at Alpine Valley, which was like Joe Satriani and Jason Bottoms band, and I can't think of who else was at that one. That might have been my first one, but I think I've told this story before. She won tickets to go see the Gin Blossoms. This was, you know, early 90s.
Nice.
At the Taste of Chicago, which is a big festival here in Chicago, if you guys aren't familiar with it. But
how many tickets did the Gin Blossoms go?
there wasn't a big crowd, so we're like, ah, whatever, we'll go, you know. So we go, and there was a band opening up for the Gin Blossoms, and I never heard of this person. It was a female singer and her band and everything, and she was amazing. Like, we could not believe how good she was and how good her band was. Never heard of her before. And then, like, 2 weeks later, Alanis Morissette releases Jagged Little Pill, her first album. And that's who it was, just the weirdest, like, like, before that she was gigantic. And we're just like, she's, you know, we didn't even care about the Gin Blossoms afterwards. You know, she was just great live. And, just a weird. I've had weird concert experiences. Not.
Sounds like it.
Yeah, it's very strange. Very strange.
What's the worst concert you've ever been to, Mitch?
Worst concert.
Yeah.
This is Concert Talk on Around Comics.
<You know? laughs> It might actually be that Everclear and Redman show.
The first is the worst.
Yeah. The sound at Roy Wilkins Auditorium is ridiculously awful.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
But me and Nicole were first dating. She was in the middle of watching Sex and the City a lot, like catching up on DVD. And when you're dating and stuff, I'd go over to her because she was still in school. She just kind of plowed through a bunch of episodes. And John Corbett was like a love interest for a while. And so, like, her her birthday or something was coming up. I can't remember what the hell it was. Maybe Valentine's Day. But I was trying to come up with something, and I was just looking through the local free magazine, and John Corbett's like country music band was coming to town. And I was like, oh, this will be hilarious. She'll love this. And so like I bought like tickets for like $12 or something like that. And like I didn't tell her the whole night what we were doing. And I'm like, you're going to be surprised. And like we get to this Fine Line Music Cafe, and she's like, ooh, who's playing? And I was like, and she was like thinking of all these like smaller bands that were local that she really liked. I'm like, nope, guess again. And like then we get there and she's like, John Corbett? And I was like, surprise. And it was horrible.
Well, it served him later in life when he was... Did you guys ever watch...
Parenthood?
No. God, what was the show? United States of Terra.
Oh, yeah.
I loved that show, but he was the husband on that, and he would often play... He would get drunk and play guitar often on there.
He had a good niche doing that for a while.
Yeah.
He did on Parenthood, too.
Did he?
Yeah. And I think he ended up as a cook at an Applebee's, and I was like... What's Applebee's?
My worst, I'm trying to think, my worst concert was probably, I saw, and this was much after their prime, I had seen Ronnie James Dio and Iron Maiden together. But this was like in, it may have been like early 2000s or something. And it was, it wasn't the singer. Steve Harris? No, not Steve Harris. What's the singer? I can't think of the singer's name now.
Oh.
The original Iron Maiden singer. Not Bruce Dickinson?
Yeah, Bruce Dickinson.
Bruce Dickinson.
The Bruce Dickinson.
Yes. It wasn't him, though. They had replaced him, and it was some young guy, like, you know, some guy in his, like, 22-year-old. That was just awful, and basically the guitarist just turned their amps on full blast to drown out the singer, and it was just so bad, we ended up leaving. Dio was probably like 45 at this time, and still had an amazing voice, and we stayed for Dio, and then left during Iron Maiden, because it was just so god-awful, it was terrible, terrible. What about, all right, one last thing. Eventually we're going to move on away from concerts, but
no way, man.
But I like the music talk. What band or artist did you miss that you wish you would have seen?
The CD.
Who?
Beastie Boys. This whole summer I've just been on a Beastie Boys kick because
yeah.
I get to see them, and I've probably blown so many chances to see them, and it was just like, oh, I'll get to see them again or something like that. And
that's a good one. Yeah, that's real good. Mitch?
I'm pretty obsessed with Springsteen, and I have missed it every time he came around.
He's coming around in like
the summer. I know, and I'm going to be gone during it.
What? Oh.
Also, for tickets for two is like $200. So.
Yeah, you have to sell your soul.
I saw Springsteen. I saw him at Soldier Field.
For free, right?
No, I paid for those. I did pay for those tickets. Those were he puts out. You know what, man? Oh man, he put.
Then Michael Jackson came up.
Michael Jackson came on stage. No, I did see Springsteen. He was good, but I like Springsteen, but I wouldn't say I'm a huge Springsteen fan. And 3 hours into a Bruce Springsteen concert, it's just like, dude, finish. Just get. I want to go home. I'm ready. That's enough Springsteen for me for the rest of my life.
I've heard he pretty much plays at the library.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and it's almost nonstop. Like he almost no breaks at all. It's pretty amazing, especially a guy his age to be able to and the way he runs around on stage and gives it. I mean, 110%. It's unbelievable. And I think that show was probably 3.5 hours long. And it was almost just nonstop, song after song after song.
See, it's kind of a bummer to hear that little detail in there, though, because one of my biggest pet peeves about going to shows is when the band doesn't talk to you in between songs.
Well, no, he does, though. Springsteen does do that, though. He'll tell some stories, and he'll talk a little bit. But, I mean, it's like maybe every, you know... 8th, 9th, 10th song. You know, he's got a lot of songs to get through.
Well, me and Mitch just went and saw in November last year or something like that. I can't believe you're going to tell this story. We went and saw Explosions in the Sky, the band who does a lot of the music for Friday Night Lights. And
oh, really?
Yeah, and they're all instrumental, but I'm like, I love their stuff. It's great to work to. And what we quickly realized is we might as well have just saved our money and just like sat in a room, drank, and listened to the CD, because they didn't say a damn word except for...
They're hardcore instrumental.
yeah. They're like, hey, Minneapolis. And then probably an hour and 10 minutes later, they were like, you've been great.
Not only did they not talk in between songs, there was no in-between songs. They just threaded every song together. Well, yeah. They literally played for like an hour and a half straight.
No kidding. That's fun. I do love the opening. Like, it's funny. I love that show. I still, every time I see one of the actors from that show, like, I'm filled with a little bit of joy and a little bit of sadness, you know, like, because the show's over, but I'm glad that they're still like those. Yeah. They remind me of those great characters. And
they should have just played the show on a giant monitor behind them, and it probably would have been my favorite concert ever. But then it turned into probably one of the most disappointing. Was like, I'm just standing around. They have a black backdrop. They have nothing. They don't move. I mean, yeah. it was like watching a really good high school band at like an all ages show. Like, I'm like, this guy's got potential. I'm like, oh shit, they've been around for 15 years already.
I went and saw this is another free concert. My sister, I don't think she won the tickets, but she had bought tickets, but the person she was going to go with couldn't go, and she asked me if I wanted to go, and I was pretty young at the time. I was probably like 19 or 20, maybe. But it was Eric Clapton, and I, you know, having grown up with older sisters and that, you know, loved the 70s, I'm a huge, like, 70s rock and roll, classic rock guy. And I was like, fuck yeah, Clapton, absolutely, I'd love to go see Clapton. But I didn't realize it was during, he had done, like, a blues tour.
Oh, yeah.
Basically, all he played was old blues songs that no one has ever fucking heard. Unless you're
that album he did with like, was it Buddy Guy or something like that, like years ago or something? I can't remember.
I don't know. Yeah, I don't remember what album. But it was just, I mean, I'm sitting there. I mean, you sit there for 2 hours, and I'm just like, play Layla, please, anything, Slow Hand. And no, it was. I mean, it start to finish, there was no change in it. It was all old blues songs. And now I would have appreciated it, but at 19, 20 years old, like, expecting Clapton, and I get that. And then he brings up, like, some old blues guy that I never heard of, and it's just like, Jesus, this is the worst frickin' concert ever, you know? I get to see Clapton, and it's, you know, a bunch of songs I've never even heard of, but...
At 18, 19, if you wanted me to listen to blues, there would have had to been, like, endless buffalo wings with it attached or something.
Yeah, exactly, you know. Like I said, at 41, which I am now, I'd love it. It would have been a great concert, I'm sure, but at 18 or 19, it was pretty awful to have to sit through that. I've had some really bizarre concert experiences in my life, but I did see... We gotta talk about comics, but I did see the Black Sabbath reunion... their first reunion at Ozfest. I did see that. Yeah, that was pretty cool. And I saw one of Stevie Ray Vaughan's last concerts before he crashed in a helicopter.
Wasn't his fault.
No, it was not.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think the band. I don't know. I had tickets to see Pearl Jam at Soldier Field back in, you know, I don't know, 95 or something, 93. I don't even know what year it was. And I got really sick and couldn't go. And I have never seen Pearl Jam. And I kind of, now I don't really give a shit. But at the time, like, I was, you know, I was really into Pearl Jam and all that shit. Mm-hmm. So, but I think Aerosmith is another band that I never got around to seeing, because I always went, I really like Aerosmith, but it's like, that's a band. Like, I'll see them eventually. It's not something, you know, they've played for five decades. Eventually I'll run into them.
Too bad you can't see them anymore. I feel like they've they'll be playing like local Walmart soon or something.
Yeah, right.
Buy a new American Idol CD. Yeah.
Talk. Good yeah. God. Let's talk a little bit about let's talk a little bit about you guys. First of all, if people aren't familiar with you guys at all, why don't you each give us a little bit about yourselves and your comic work and how you guys know each other? Because I didn't know that you guys were friends. I've known Brent for a while now, but Mitch, we've never actually met.
I'm he gives me money.
Oh, yeah. All right.
I think I do. It's like $20 for a pizza, Becca.
So, yeah. Brent, in case people aren't familiar with your work, why don't you give us just a little rundown on some of your comic work? Because I don't, because I'm lazy and I really don't want to have to think of it or research it. So it's easier if I just ask you.
Look at it again. My name is Brent Schoonover. I've done. The first book I did was called Horrorwood. It came back in the a couple of years ago. I think it was 2007 with Ape Entertainment. I have a book called Astronaut Dad that is a 180-page graphic novel, and that is available on Amazon now if you just look up Astronaut Dad. And then I also did a book called Mr. Murder is Dead, which is through Archaea. It's an original graphic novel, and I've done some work for Hackslash here and there. And I've got some... Right now, I can't really announce anything new quite yet, but I would say sometime towards the beginning of 2013, we'll probably have a lot more stuff to talk about.
And let me, before we go, I just want to mention Mr. Murder is Dead is a gorgeous hardcover, by the way.
Oh,
in case I haven't told you that already.
You have, but I have appreciate telling me again. So, thank you very much. So, no, I'm very proud of that book. I love the way it turned out, and it was like, I don't know, it was such a blast to work on that. Like, every project from here on out, it's just, I want to have that much fun working on it. Otherwise, it's really not worth it. Like, I just, it's the most fun I've ever had. So, thank you.
Oh, absolutely. No, it's fantastic. It's kind of a tour de force of comic styles, too, I think. It's just, you pulled off so many different kind of, I don't even want to say homage to different things, but just the different flavors you put in that book is pretty amazing.
Yeah, it's like a love letter to comic strips, which is like my favorite thing, because I don't know how many people really identify with it anymore, but that was my first exposure to comics, really, was just opening the paper. It was this free thing that came, you know, to your doorstep every day, and we didn't have, I mean, I grew up in a small town called South Beloit, Illinois, and so there was a comic shop in Rockford, Illinois, but that was like 25 minutes to a half hour away. So, you know, when you're a kid, you're not going every week. And so your closest exposure to everything was the daily comic strips and stuff like that. So I was a big Dick Tracy fan when I was really young. And, you know, so when that movie came out, I was so excited because that was probably the closest character that I had to me because, like I said, he was there every day at my doorstep, you know, reading that, you know, short little four or five panels every day.
Right.
So, yeah, it was kind of fun to write this sort of, I don't know if it, I say it's a love letter to Dick Tracy, but I imagine a lot of Dick Tracy fans probably would hate if that was really Dick Tracy, but it goes on to the main character, Gold Kane. But yeah, man, it was super fun. Victor Kinaj, the writer, it was like, I'd never met him before, but it was like we had the same childhood and the same interests, so it was a good collaboration.
Did you like the Dick Tracy movie with, oh God, now I can't think of the cast. It's Madonna
Warren Beatty. Gino. I mean, as a kid, it was so colorful, and it looked like a comic book. And I mean, you rewatch it again, and it's certainly flawed. I mean, I would put it right up there with like sort of like Tim Burton's Batman movie. That like, you know, it's more about style than it is about substance. You know,
I thought they really captured Dick Tracy to me. Like, you know what I mean? Like, that was the strip. I thought they did a great job with you know, kind of capturing the feel of it and the fun of it, and you know, some of the great villains that you know that they recreated in there, I thought was fantastic.
Absolutely. You know, I've always heard that they're talking about rebooting Dick Tracy as like this dark and gritty kind of cop. Like, I feel like we've had that, you know, like there's other characters you can go through and do that. And, you know, when we were really promoting Mr. Murder a lot, was like, is this just a book that you're doing because you can't get the rights to Dick Tracy? And I was like, no, because honestly, like, I don't want Dick Tracy to be like this character in our book. Like, he needs to be the way he is, you know, like, you know, and, you know, like, it should be this thing that everybody can read and stuff like that. I mean, that was what made him so enjoyable. And I thought they did a good job with the movie of doing that. So, yeah. Like I said, the movie certainly got flaws, but it's certainly got this nostalgia and the style and stuff that it's something that I would say I'd easily go back to and watch and enjoy.
Cool. And Mitch, tell me about yourself.
I like long walks on the beach.
What's your sign?
As far as comic stuff goes, I don't want to delve into my history, but as far as comic stuff goes, I did kind of like Brent, you know, started out with a small book called Johnny Recon, and that was mainly self-published. We self-published the first issue and brought that to a few conventions, me and a good friend of mine, Scott Dillon, and it kind of got some interest there, and then we brought the second issue to Kickstarter, and we were the first like mainstream comic book on Kickstarter. So it's kind of fun to see Kickstarter go crazy now and nobody remembers.
Someone's giving you respect.
I know, respect. Actually, I was at a convention recently and I was next to, I don't want to say who it was, I don't want to call him out, but I was next to a pretty, you know, big name in the industry from one of the big two, and they were all talking about Kickstarter, and someone said something about, you know, the first book on Kickstarter, and he corrected him. He said, no, that's that Mitch Gerald's Johnny Recon book. And I was like, I'll let you get my name wrong. As long as you remember. But no, after Johnny, let's see, what came next? I think that's when Comic Twart started to kick in. We all started that, a bunch of guys on Twitter, Chris Somni and Tom Fowler and Declan Shelby and Evan Shaner and, you know, a whole host of people. And some editors, you know, were checking that every day because obviously got all this talent on there, and I got hooked up with Boom, and I was coloring Stan Lee's Starborn. I colored that whole series, issues 1 through 12, and the coolest thing, though, is my first, like, professional comics gig was the variant cover to Starborn number 1. I did pencils, inks, and colors on it, but it was super limited, and in fact, it was limited to, I don't know what the actual number is, but every issue was actually signed by Stan Lee. So I like, you know, at some point Stan Lee had to sit in a room and sign, you know, 200, 300 copies of my cover, and he's probably sick of looking at it. But so that was my first like actual comics gig, and then I colored that series and did a lot of little coloring gigs here and there, and that's kind of when Nathan Edmondson called me up and pitched the Activity, and I've been working on the Activity ever since. Issue 8 comes out in a couple weeks, I believe, and I did a Doctor Who special last year for IDW, and then I did one this year, which actually comes out next week, the Doctor Who 2012 special, they're calling it. But yeah, and then the Activity, that's where I'm at now for Image.
It's funny, you know, I you know, just as being a comic observer, your career I've really seen from Johnny Recon on, and I've been a huge fan of yours. I'm sure at one time or another I commented on your stuff and on either DeviantArt or on your blog or on Comic Twart, you know, because I've been a really big fan of your work from the earliest times that I've seen him, which was the Johnny Recon covers. When those started coming out, I remember talking about it, I think, on the show, and I loved the covers on that. And then when you guys started the Comic Twart thing, I mean, that was, let me say, that was a brilliant stroke by you guys to put yourselves together and just start putting out I imagine a lot of you guys have gotten work from that, or at least gotten noticed from that, because, I mean, it was just amazing, the stuff that was coming out of there. You guys were just kicking ass on that thing. But,
well, I talk about this in a lot of my interviews, but, like, Twitter was, like, the number one instrumental thing in my career, going from when I worked, I did cereal box illustration for 5 years before I ever started comic books. And I got let go from that job. There's layoffs because we lost an account. And I was just sitting there, and I was like, all right, well, I've got unemployment, and I can either go find another design job, which I like, but, you know, the passion really isn't there, or I can take a little bit of time and see if this whole comic book thing I've wanted to do since I was a kid worked out. And it started to work out, and it's all because of Twitter and just meeting people and starting Comic Tort. And the funny thing now is Comic Tort hasn't been updated in...
It's because it worked.
Everybody's too busy.
And I would say, too, the best thing I could say about Comic Tort, having not been involved in it, but still, like, it's a model that everybody's... a lot of people are still trying to replicate. Like,
oh, yeah, yeah.
There's a lot of cool... I mean, I do a lot of stuff for Ashcan All-Stars, and, I mean, I think that one's really cool. But at the same time, I think everybody would be honest and say, like, that there wouldn't be one if it wasn't for how everybody saw how well Comic Tort was doing, you know?
Well, the thing about Comic Tort, too, which I thought was so cool, because I you know, since I started the podcast with Chris and Tom, or, you know, whatever, 7-8 years ago, and our thing was always trying to, find new, like, overlooked, or just guys that are just getting into the business, or books that are just, you know, smaller books, that kind of thing. Because it was our philosophy was just like, hey, you know what, X-Men's going to sell 80,000 copies no matter what we say about it. But if we talk about a little tiny book that we really like, maybe we can help that book, you know? And so I've always been sort of looking at, you know, looking for stuff, looking for guys that are, I think, are really good that maybe don't get any notice or don't get a lot of notice in the industry. And to me, like, the Comic Tort thing was just like a bunch of really good, talented artists that said, you know what, fuck this, we need to get together and show the comic world how fucking good we are. And that's, I mean, I have no idea what the genesis of Comic Tort was.
I could picture Chris Somney saying that.
I
swear.
But that was the, you know what I mean? Like, that to me was what it looked like from the outside, of just like a bunch of guys going, yeah, people need to see this art. And it was, and like you said, it worked. I thought, the stuff that was coming out of there was phenomenal. And it's obviously gotten you guys a lot of different exposure and that kind of thing. So, you know, it's great. But like I said, I was a fan of your work before that on the Johnny Recon stuff. I really liked your style, and just those covers just really caught my eye. But then watching on, you know, Comic Tort and that's, it was funny that when I started talking to Brent about coming on the show, he's like, hey, can Mitch come on too? I'm like, yeah, absolutely. I'd never met you before, but I've been a fan for a long time. So I just wanted to, you know.
Awesome. Thanks, man. It's so crazy to hear that people actually latched on at the Johnny stage.
Well, there's a couple of us out here at least, I know, you know. But well, how did you guys meet? What is your relationship, or where, you know? Not, I guess, what is your relationship? But how did you guys become?
We met through I'd seen a Johnny Recon postcard at my local comic shop, and local comics can be kind of hit and miss, you know. You're like, this one looks horrible, but
right,
you know, I'm gonna be seeing this guy a lot at a convention, so I might as well sort of, you know, be nice about it. But no, Mitch made these awesome postcards, and I was like, who the hell, what, this guy's local, like, this is awesome. And he ended up stopping by my table, I think, at a local con, and we just kind of, you know, started talking and stuff, and he wasn't crazy, and I was like, hey, this guy's normal, and this is awesome. So
what's funny is the amount of shows and appearances and stuff that we were like 10 feet away from each other, but we had not met yet at this point, so like neither one of us approached the other one.
That's right. It's true. It's true. But I don't, I'd say in Minneapolis, we have a nice but yet very small crew of working professional comic artists. Xander and Kevin Cannon are probably the most well-known. You know, they worked on, well, Xander did Replacement Gods with Alan Moore. And, you know, Gene Ha used to be up here, but I think he's actually in Chicago now.
Yeah.
And, you know, Terry Beatty, who used to work on a lot of the Batman, the animated series books, he just recently left for Kansas City. But, you know, Jim Keepy, who did, I think, Flash Gordon for the comic strip for a long time. But, you know, there's just a really good crew of guys, and kind of, like, small, but I don't know. Ever since me and Mitch started hanging out, we started making, like, a... I don't think it's every month, but it's every other month we kind of get together. We have a really cool bar called Donnie Dirk's Zombie Den. It's, like, a dark little small hole-in-the-wall bar. And, like, me, him, Peter Krause, he does Insufferable at Thrillbent.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I just... Yeah. I just tweeted about that today because it's really good.
Yeah, yeah. And so we all kind of get together and just kind of catch up and chat and stuff. And it's nice. So am I missing anything, Mitch?
Nope.
I was going to ask you guys, you're both, you had mentioned you were a cereal box illustrator, Mitch, and Brent, I know you're a commercial artist. You do a lot of commercial illustration work, that kind of thing. And,
yep.
You know, I've talked to you privately sometimes, you know, about just how you are trying to balance that. You know, it's like the comics work is great and you'd love it, but the, you know, commercial stuff is what pays the bills. And so it's that balancing act. Can you talk a little bit about how, you know, how you make up that, those decisions or what that's like kind of trying to balance the two? Because, you know, as I'm sure most people should know by now, is that as much as you love doing comic book work, sometimes it just doesn't pay very much.
Sure. Well, for me, it's really, yeah, I do a lot of commercial work. And that's obviously pays a little better than comics and stuff. But, like, comics are, like, I can't not do them. They're, like, it's just what I have to do. And so, really, for me, like, when I really have, like, a project that I feel strongly about, it's something I need to do. For me, it's really just more, like, I need to, like, kind of chat with the wife and kind of be on the same page about, like, this is going to be, like, a schedule for the next X amount of months and stuff and, not, you know, get this thing done. And when I was doing Mr. Murder, she was actually, the Mr. Murder got started like right at the tail end of when our daughter Josie was being born. So it was kind of scary because we didn't really know what the schedule was going to be like. You know, it's like, I can't exactly say like in the past, like, well, I need to work from this time to this time and, you know, we're good to go. And so, you know, it, we kind of just make it work, you know, and I try not to do too many weekends in a row where, you know, I'm down in the basement and she can't, you know, I don't see them and stuff like that. You know, I try to, it's important to me to make sure that you make family time and stuff like that. So, really for that, it's just communication. And I probably put in, like today, I put in a good 8 or 9 hour day on commercial work and I'm working on personal stuff as I'm talking to you. And I'll probably work till, you know, 1:32 in the morning and then I'll get up around 6:30 with the kid, stuff like that. Kind of start again. So it's a lot of hours. I mean, I know, like, Mitch, you just talked about a 13-hour day yesterday, and, you know, it's still, like, the same amount of hours. They're just sort of jumbled around a little bit. So this year I've been really, really busy with a lot of commercial work, and I haven't really been able to do a lot of comic books. And my wife got a new job, which kind of requires some more time. So this year, like I said before we went on air, that comics have sort of had to take a backseat for a little bit, but now this fall is starting to look pretty good, and I'm starting to make plans for next year. So, you know, it's just, it's a lot more organizing and planning than it used to be, but that's just how it works out if you want to do these kind of things on your own time, you know, so.
What about you? What about you?
Yeah, I kind of do not quite the same thing, because I've got, you know, the monthly book that I do pencils, inks, and colors on, but I do a mix of different commercial illustration gigs here and there just to kind of supplement that income. And it's always kind of bugged me when you read these fan reviews and stuff where people are like, oh, you know, they just phone that in. They must not even care about this comic. If you're in comic books, you care about comic books because the money is elsewhere.
Right.
Not to say you can't make money in this industry. You definitely can. It's awesome. But, like, I can do a very simple commercial illustration and generally I'll get paid I get paid for, you know, an issue of the activity. And so, you know, it's just juggling those things. And right now, just like I don't have the kid like Brent does. So I have a little extra money to play with. And, I just supplement that income and keep cracking on the comic and make sure I can pay my bills every month and make sure I have some playing around money too. And just, I love the activity so much that I'm just sticking with it and trying to be on time and rocking it out.
You were taking some, like, from time to take on a commercial gig, like, early on, I remember, and then the activity first started and stuff, like, some of your old contacts would come to you, and it was like, it's good quick money if you put a little time or something like that.
Right? I still have a lot of little quick jobs I do here and there. It's been a while since I've taken on, like, a full-scale commercial gig.
But yeah.
I'll do little commercial things here and there, little spot illustrations for different things, and there's like a healthcare website that I am like the sole illustrator for. So anytime they want to add something, they have to come to me, and those I can knock out and, you know, knock out two or three a day. So I do those, but.
You said something really interesting and I've talked about this before with a couple of people on the show about, you know, if you're in comics, you care about it. And, you know, I kind of brought up the idea of that it's, you know, almost Darwinian in the sense of, the people that are making comics have to be really passionate about it because it's so frickin' hard to do that you can't just kind of half-ass it, or you can't come into it not giving a damn because it's too much work and oftentimes so little reward that you have to be passionate. You have to be dedicated to it. And so that, to me, makes comics stronger.
Absolutely. You know, I would totally agree.
Yeah, we don't know any better. I
mean, it's true.
Don't know what else to do with yourself. You just have to do comics. And I think it shows. I mean, you know, if you look at comics at a whole, no matter, you know, obviously we see so much more kind of bitching and complaining because of the internet and Twitter and that kind of stuff where it's easier to do. But if you really, you know, kind of look at the quality of books that are out today and take away any of the ideas of, like, distribution and pricing and all that business side of it, but just the quality of the books that are produced, you know, there are way more really good comics on the stands today than I think maybe ever in history, you know?
Absolutely. Me and Brent talk about this a lot because, you know, we each have a different local comic shop that we go to and usually end up texting each other all day, every day. So we'll go to our store on Wednesday and we'll come back and be like, geez, dude, I spent, you know, 40 bucks, 30 bucks, whatever. And it's like, I think about it and it boggles my mind that anyone could be like, you know, comics aren't what they used to be or whatever. In my entire life, I've never spent each month as much as I do each week as I do right now because there's so much greatness out there. And I feel like I've cut down like tons and I'm still spending this much. There's just like every company's putting out phenomenal work.
Well, and the beautiful thing is you can, you know, like I've moved a bit away from superhero comics into other stuff. And I just kind of enjoy other different kind of comic books. And the great thing is, you know, you see more and more diversity in it too than you know, you used to. It's not just, I mean, as much as Marvel and DC dominate comic book stands, there's still, you know, there's a bunch of different publishers and they're all putting out good books and there's so many quality creators now and artists and writers and that kind of thing that you just see whatever you want. You know, if you want a horror book, there's going to be good horror books. If you want a Western, there's, you know, even good Westerns. If you want crime, if you want whatever, that, you know, it's pretty much you're going to be able to find something good to read.
Well, yeah, and I mean, the cool thing now, too, is if you can't find it at your store, you can probably find one online.
Yeah.
If you're just not getting an itch that's getting scratched particularly, like, I was late to the party, but this last 2 weeks I've been catching up on God Hates Astronauts.
Oh, yeah.
It's my favorite freaking, like, online comics right now. I think it's so hilarious and fun, and I'm just like, I didn't realize how long this thing had been going on, and I mean, there was no excuse. I think I'd heard about it. I just didn't really make the time to invest in checking it out. And like now, it's just like, anybody was just like, "Hey, what are you digging on right now?" That would probably be the first thing I would say. It's just this weird, wacky little comic book that you can read online for free, and I mean, that's pretty awesome. So,
well, you had mentioned Insufferable by Mark Waid and Peter Krause, right?
Yep.
And like that was, you know, that's a book that I knew it was out there. I knew it started coming out. I was like, oh, okay, I'll eventually go and check that out. And I, you know, ended up the other day, like, reading the whole thing online. I'm like, wow, this is really good. I mean, this is a really good, free, cool comic book story. You know what I mean? Done really, really well. That's why, you know, I went on Twitter. I'm like, hey, you need to read, you know, people need to know about this. If they're not reading it already, it's like, this is really good. And it's free. You know, it's like, so, I mean, and yeah, Ryan Brown, who we've had on the show, he's a Chicago guy. And, you know, his stuff, God Hates Astronaut, is just one of the most unique comics out there. I mean, he's super talented, and it's just crazy and funny and kind of madcap stuff. And, you know, with Ryan, I've told him before, it's just like, just please keep doing what you're doing. I know it's hard. You know, I know it's tough sometimes because he's one of those creators that his stuff doesn't necessarily fit into the box. You know what I mean? Like, but it's like, we need guys like that in comics. We need guys like that to keep doing it somehow. Because it's only going to make it better.
Yep, I agree. It's funny you mentioned that issue because I was at the comic book shop today and we were talking and I was just saying how much I love Daredevil 2, and the guy was like, that issue where I went on the date, he's like, it did nothing for me. It's like they're doing nothing. And like with you, I'm like, that was like the best issue, like, you know, and the direction that book's been going where it's just a little more lighthearted. And I've always liked Daredevil a lot, and I love Bendis's run. I love all that dark stuff, but like, it is one of those things of like, you can only take that character in that direction for so long, and then you have to kind of turn a corner and give the audience something different, I think. And I think that this book's been doing a really good job of that. And like with you, I was just like, I love that issue where he was on the date and stuff like that. But it's funny how those directions are very polarizing for the fan base. Like, you know, some people like it and some people are just like, whatever. I mean, you're paying X amount of money for an issue, and you're kind of hoping, like, these are superhero books. Like, so I do get it, stuff like that. And, like, that's why I say I think the first issue of Hawkeye was super fun to me. But, like, I'm really surprised that they were, like, refresh off of a movie, you know, and stuff, too. Like, this is what you want to give them. But, like, I don't know. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, and on that same, like, the flip of the coin on that works the other way, too. Like, I loved that Avengers issue, and I loved that Daredevil issue. But if that's all those two titles were, it bore the shit out of me.
Right. Yeah, I think that was, I think that was my problem a little bit with the Avengers, because after a while it seemed like that was, I mean, he's, you know, he would mix it up, but it seemed like there was a lot, and it's been a comment on it for a while, is that there was a lot of those guys sitting around, you know what I mean? And I think sometimes Bendis, you know, one of his faults is that he pays too much attention to the online world and the commentary from people, because I think sometimes he does things just in spite of what people say. You know what I mean? Like, it's, you know, that kind of thing. But I did want to, you know, like the Daredevil relaunch that they did with Wade and you know, oh God, who was the first?
Paul Rivera.
I absolutely love that. And I'm a huge Daredevil fan, but, you know, what you said was right, is that, you know, eventually that, you know, just tearing him down, and that's what it, you know, became after Frank Miller did it, you know, in the beginning, you know, of his stuff, of just, like, tearing that character down. It became sort of, he became that punching bag. And, you know, everybody kind of did that, their take on it, you know what I mean? As much as Ben, I don't, you know, I think Bendis's run is great on Daredevil, and I don't want to suggest that, like, he was just doing his Frank Miller impersonation, but he was doing the same sort of thing of just, like, how low can we make things for him? And that's great, but after a while, it just gets to be, like, noise, you know? And it's
the funny thing both about Bendis's run and Brubaker's run, they're both phenomenal. If you read them month to month, it's like great. Like, oh, this is awesome. If you read those omnibuses, all like you sit down, you take 2 hours, and you just start reading one of those omnibuses, it's like, holy cow, this guy, like, never has a good day. Ever. Like, it's just one thing after another. And it's like, you start to think about it, it's like, how can this guy take this? Like, eventually, he just kind of crawl in a corner.
He's going to crack. There's no way that he, you know. But I love that. I love the way Wade sort of even handled that, in the sense of, like, you know, he kind of took it in the direction of, like, I have nothing left to fear because I've been through everything. You know what I mean? You can't hurt me any longer. There's nothing. Yeah, yeah. And so I'm not going to be afraid of anything. I'm the man without fear, and I'm going to act like it again. And yeah, I absolutely have loved what they've done.
He's done a good job of giving Matt Murdock a snarkiness to him that is not just as simple as, like, snarky Spider-Man, you know, or, like, because for a long time I always felt like, well, there's these characters in comics that were supposed to be, like, kind of like, I'd hate to say it, they're supposed to be like Chandler from Friends, and it was just like, this is what Speedball is, that's what Spider-Man is, that's what Nova is, and, like, they would try to do that with Daredevil from time to time, and it just didn't seem to work, and I just feel like Mark has given that sort of vibe to him, like its own personality, you know.
Absolutely. So you guys want to hear my awesome Fear Itself Daredevil idea?
Let's do it.
Actually, it's partially my brother's, and I kind of ran with it, so I'll give him credit. But how amazing! So I came up with this before Fear Itself actually started. How amazing would it be? So Fear Itself happens. It gets to the point, you know, where that Fear God guy came in and just wiped everyone out. The heroes can't get back, whatever. And at the very end,
I love this was at the time. I love that we're doing fan fiction at this point.
I know. Because this is at the time when Daredevil was off on that weird thing where he was like evil, and
the hand.
But then he like left, the hand. And then he wasn't around anymore. Matt Murdock wasn't there. And Black Panther took over. But, so how awesome would it be if this is how Matt Murdock came back to the U and the Marvel U and like defeated all the Fear Itself, you know, baddies, because he's the man without fear. Like the one character in the entire Marvel universe who could defeat these people because he doesn't have any fear. And I thought that was how Fraction was going to run with it. And then, you know, around issue 3, you realize that wasn't at all, and I was so disappointed.
There's no way they would let Daredevil have that big of a role.
I know.
You know what I mean?
I just wanted Daredevil to be, like, the huge plot point.
Yeah. It would have been sweet. It's funny that you've been to, like, think about things like that, because, because yesterday was Kirby's birthday, you know, and everybody was posting all these things about Kirby. And for the longest time, I, like, off and on while I'm working, like, I love Mr. Miracle a lot. Like, it is probably, out of all of that Jack Kirby's done, it's one of my favorite things. And I think the alias Scott Free is the greatest character name ever. Like, it's just so
perfect.
I can't believe. Yeah, I mean, it's just like, how did it take so long for someone to come up with the escape artist superhero named Scott Free? But I was just, like, all day yesterday. I was probably up till about 1:30 or 2 last night. And I was working, but mostly all I was doing was thinking about, like, this whole run, if I could ever get Mr. Miracle. Like, I just think it would be awesome. And I don't know. So it's funny that when Mitch started talking about how this is how I would have done it, like, I have those things, too, from time to time where I just, like, if I could do this, this is what I'd do. So,
right.
Yeah, so hopefully someday I get to do it, but we'll see. I'm not holding my breath.
I do love Mr. Miracle. He is a phenomenal character, and has probably always been my favorite Kirby creation, too.
I would say if you were going to reintroduce him, you've got to do something with that costume to tone it down, because he just looked like a ridiculous Christmas tree. And
they kind of did in Morrison's... They kind of toned it down. But that was
Seven Soldiers, was that what it was? Or
no, it was the DC... I can't think of it now. I can't think of what the hell... Not 52 or One Day Later or 1 Million Years Later or... I don't know what it... I can't remember what the heck... Too many events, I can't keep up
with it. It's not even scot-free anymore.
It was some other guy. It was a different Mr. Miracle. Because
that's great, you know. You've got the greatest name in the world. Let's give it to somebody else. Yeah.
Well, it's...
Johnny that's never gets out of it.
All up in the air now, though.
Yeah, I know, with Wonder Woman.
What about Wonder
Woman? I was just saying because of the relaunch.
Oh, I thought you were... Because, spoiler alert, they're hinting that the New Gods are coming back through the last issue of Wonder Woman. So.
Okay.
Orion.
Have you guys read Azzarello's Wonder Woman?
It is amazing. That was one of my next books, I was going to say. I couldn't give two craps about a Wonder Woman comic ever before, but Cliff Chang was drawing it. And I had to pick it up. I'm like, oh, I'm going to be picking this up, but I'm not really even going to be reading it. It is probably next to Batman, my favorite 52 book.
I picked it up. I picked all the Chang issues up, and I never picked up any of the fill-ins, and it started to get filled in so much that I have no clue what's happening now, so I just kind of dropped the whole thing.
I'll let you borrow them.
I
like it a lot.
I started reading it, and then I kind of fell off from it. But I want to go back. I really enjoyed it, but I do that with so many books and so many different titles that it's just like, I'll get to it or I'll pick up the trade, you know. But I think I read the first three issues of it, and I loved what he was doing with it. I'm a huge fan of Azzarello's anyway, but with Cliff Chang, the combination of those two together, I absolutely loved it.
I'm not reading Justice League right now, where she's being your typical superhero, but I love that, like, in Wonder Woman, it's just enough that she's a god on Earth, and it's like she's doing heroic things, but she's not patrolling, she's not going and punching bad guys, bad villains. Like, there's one issue where she's just at a freaking club going to see a band, because, like, that's what you do, and, like, I don't know. They brought this human element to it that I don't know. I've never really gave Wonder Woman a fair shot before in the past, and maybe this was there.
Don't apologize for not liking a female superhero. Come on. I am so tired of, like, you know, we feel like we have to. Listen, I have nothing in common with superheroes, let alone a woman. That, you know what I mean? Like, I don't have to feel bad about not liking Wonder Woman as a comic book. First of all, it hasn't been very frickin' good ever. And secondly, it's like, I don't have anything in common with this person. I have nothing to relate to about this character. How, you know, so...
The set of the character, like, she's an Amazon, but she drives an invisible jet. Like,
she has... All right, that is pretty awesome, now that you say it like that. I loved. Did you guys ever read that backup that Cliff Chang and Azzarello had done?
Dr. 13.
Yes. Yes. God, I loved that. And I, Azzarello's a local guy, so I've had plenty of meeting. You know, I've met with him plenty of times, talked with him. You know, hung out with him a handful of times, and. The one thing I would say about Brian is I don't think he's a very funny guy. Like, he doesn't come off... He's not a guy that it tells jokes. He's not a, you know, a snappy kind of, you know, funny talking guy. He's a pretty intense, serious dude. And so when he was doing that, I couldn't believe how hilarious that book is.
Yeah. Yeah, that was good stuff. I think that was kind of, I forget what Cliff Chang had done that first caught my eye, but he has just become one of these like guys that, like, I don't care what it is that he's doing, I will pick it up because it's probably going to just kick some serious ass. So,
I agree. Do you guys find that you follow more artists and creators than characters nowadays?
I'm exclusively just an artist follower. I'm sorry, Mitch. I'll shut up to you.
Yeah, I was going to say the same thing. I'm completely on creators, so I can buy a book for 20 issue run, and if it's a guest artist that I don't like or a guest writer or whatever, I'll drop it and I'll come back when it's who I like, and I'll go pick up a book I've never read that character before in my life if it's got the right artist on it. Like, I'm in it for the creativeness, and I just love following the creatives that I enjoy.
No, I'm the same way. I can't read a book any longer if it's bad. If I don't like the art, if I don't, you know, I don't have to necessarily know the name, but if I pick it up and look, you know, flip through it, I see some preview pages of it, and it's just, it, you know, if I don't dig the art of it, it's like, I'm not giving it a chance. There's no way.
And I've become pretty discriminating about it too. Like, you've got to be pretty good to get me to buy your book right now. Yeah, it says a lot about the industry though, that I am spending, you know, 30, 40 bucks a week.
I drive a friend of mine. We go to the comic shop. This is going to sound funny because, like, on Wednesdays, I have my daughter all day, and then my friend has his son all day. So it's like we go to a park with our kids, and then we go right over to the comic shop. It's like we're a little date or something like that. But also, like, every Wednesday when we meet up, I swap the books that I buy and give it to him so he can read more titles without paying for them, and I do the same with him. And he is like that classic comic book guy where he just can't not collect a book, even if it sucks, because it's like, I've been collecting for 15 years, and it's just like, whatever.
Right.
Mitch had said, like, I will drop a book, like, if it just has a fill-in artist that I don't like, then I don't pick up that issue, and then I'll pick it up the following issue. So, like, I'll give him my books, and he'll be like, hey, I missed issue 16 of whatever, and I'm like, oh, I didn't pick it up because I didn't like the art, and he was like, you could tell he just kind of had that FU face, like, come on, man. Like, so I don't care. I mean, it'll be easy to pick up for me. And it's just, it's one less issue laying around. And, you know, so, but yeah, that's kind of where
I've definitely gotten a lot more discriminate on that kind of stuff. And I certainly was in the camp of, like, there were characters that I would buy. And there's still, like, there are still characters that I go back and will try. Like, I'll go, okay, I'm going to try this X-Men book one more time, or I'm going to, you know, oh, they're relaunching the X-Men again, or they're relaunching Batman again, or, you know, whatever, Spider-Man, Daredevil, that kind of thing. And it's like, okay, I'm going to try it again, but inevitably I'm usually disappointed by it. And it's just like, oh, I can't, you know, and I've gotten with it with both the writing and the art. The art is a little easier though, because, you know, you pick up a book, you flip through it, you know, right away. The writing, it's like you got to read a half a dozen pages at least before you get a feeling of how it's being written. But I've gotten to the point now where, you know, I'll start reading something and it's just like, oh, this is not good. I won't even finish it any, you know, that kind of thing. Cause it just annoys me now. Like, I'm not going to waste my time with something that isn't very good.
Well, issues are so expensive too now. And even digitally, I mean, it's a commitment, you know, like, I mean, I've got a tier process now of, like, I will collect this every month because I need it, or, like, I can let this one sit until, like, a comic convention where I can probably, or our local shop does, like, a lot of books. They'll do, like, especially miniseries, they'll let it, like, it's a 4-issue miniseries. Once the 4 issues is wrapped up and the trade is out, they'll polybag the 4 issues, and they'll sell them for, like, 4 issues for, like, $4 or something like that, just to get them out of the place. And I'll wait for something like that. Or, digitally and stuff like that, too. Like, it's so funny. I have, like, this little tier mechanism of, like, this is good, but it's not that great. So I'll just, for me, it's like, if there's an artist that I like but I don't really get influenced by them, I don't need that physical copy around my desk. I'll just pick it up digitally just to, like, save space.
Right.
That's become another part of my discriminating, like, purchasing is not only do you have to be a good artist, but you have to be someone that influences me.
Yep. Same here.
No, and now I'll, I mean, there's, I used to laugh, Scotty, when he used to do the show, Scotty Young, he would oftentimes talk about how he would buy comics and never read them, just look at the art, and just flip through them and look at the art. And I'm like, how the hell, you know, why would you do that? Why, you know, but I've certainly gotten to that point on something that's just like, oh, this is great art, but I don't care about this character, or I don't care about this story, but I just want to look at the book. I just want to look at the pages and look at the scenes and the panels. And I do that sometimes. I'll pick stuff up that I was just like, ah, I don't, you know, I don't really care about the story, but the art is fantastic. And I have to, you know, I have to kind of try and, somehow eat the artist's soul through his work and steal all of his talent, but that doesn't seem to be working too well.
I'll tell you the best book I picked up today, Little Homer, number one.
Little
Homer? Yeah.
What is that? I don't know that book. What is
Little Homer?
The little bongo book?
Yep. Bongo, it's like Little Homer Simpson.
Oh, really? Like,
yeah.
When he was young yeah. Homer Simpson? Who's doing that? Who, is that?
It's Bongo Comics.
No, I meant
who's creatively on it.
Yeah.
Let's see.
Is that art or not art?
Carol Lay?
I don't know that one. I don't know who Carol is. I know.
Calzea? I don't know. I really don't think those. Like, the Halloween issues are always, like, mainstream artists we know. But they're, like, normal issues are kind of, they're, like, in-house people.
Oh, right. I know Hilary Barta does a lot of stuff for Bongo. Or at least he did. Do you guys ever run into, do you ever have, like, well, two things. Do you ever have stuff you buy just because you know the guy doing it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The activity? Is that what you're saying?
The activity is quality. I like it. No, I do feel like, I'll tell you what's worse than buying, having to feel like you got to buy a book because you know somebody is having to do Kickstarter. That's the tough thing.
Yeah.
It's like, that's the ultimate guilt trip right there is, you know, like, I don't really think this book is going to be worth a shit, but, like, I'm going to see this guy six times this year, so I better buy this.
That is a tough thing, though, like, when, you know, me and Brent go to, you know, usually, like, 3-4 shows a year, and, you know, you meet different people and you become friends with them. It's really tough, like, wanting, like, oh, I want to hang out with this guy all the time. He's really cool. I really jive, but I just don't like his work. It's really strange, and it's really kind of hard to pull off, especially when everyone starts talking about the work.
Yeah.
Well, I've just recently started to go to conventions as an artist, you know, and setting up a table and selling stuff, and it's great, and I'm having a good time, and, you know, for me, it's more just an excuse to go, and if I make a few bucks, awesome. But, you know, being a nobody artist and no name, they generally put me in, you know, the ass end of Artist Alley, and I'm surrounded by, you know, other artists of the same or less quality, and it's great. Like, you meet people, and people at Artist Alley are fantastic, and you know, like you said, you get to know people, but then it's like, you know, they come over and compliment you on your stuff, and it's like, yeah, you're awesome.
You're getting there.
Yeah. And not that I'm a great artist, but, I mean, you know, there's some...
Brent and I know exactly what you're talking about. We've had this conversation
we can watch it happen to each other. It's the book trade-off, because comic books are currency at conventions so much that it's like... I think, like, especially with Mr. Murder, it's this hardcover book that, you know, I mean, it's expensive. And, like, I had a guy come up to me. I've had a couple times where people have come up to me and they want to give me, like, two copies of, like, their Kinko's books that they've done. And it's like, and I'll take one of those Mr. Murders, please. And it's like, no, like, you know, I don't get unlimited copies of these either. So it's made some for some awkward situations for me. And like, it's just like, okay. And it is, it's, you feel bad because like they seem totally cool, but at the same time, their work just isn't something that you want to take home with you. And it's like they're just throwing it out there on Front Street that they just are ready to do the comic swap. And it's just, yeah, it's kind of tough. But you know, I think for the most part, like I've got friends too that like from the comic industry that like we talk and stuff like all that. But like, I don't think I've ever really, like, if I were to go back and be like, you know, they've never really complimented me at anything. Yeah. And it's like, I just think you just can't sweat that stuff too much, and you just kind of got to enjoy company and stuff like that. So,
yeah.
But, yeah.
And I guess the other thing is, has there been stuff that you really want to like, but, you know, whether it's a title or a character or something or someone that's working on something, and you don't have to name names, but you just don't, like, you know, because I have that all the time. Like, I'll be like, oh, I really, you know, well, like I talked about before, it's like, oh, I really want to like the X-Men again or something like that. And it's just like, yeah, I just don't, it's not good. Or, you know, or you almost try and convince yourself into buying something because you want it to be good or want it to be better than it turns out to be.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. Yep. I think that happened to me a lot during the New 52. Like, I wanted all of those titles to be phenomenal, so I started buying a lot of those New 52 titles, and it took me a while to realize, I'm like, I'm not digging this for a few of them. And we'll just say that the amount of New 52 books I was getting when it first started to now is quite a different number.
Well, you and everybody else, I think.
Right? Yeah.
But I still give, you know, DC a lot of credit for doing what they did with it. I think it was a huge, huge move and one to try and, you know, keep up with.
The thing I laugh about is that everybody acts like it's over. Like, they can't, like, oh, they failed. And it's like, no, yeah. I mean, like, no. These books come in waves, and it's like, if Hawkman sucks, Hawkman won't be around because he's, you know, again, and he'll come back in 2 years when, like, always, and, you know, they'll try, like, you know, they're like, where's Justice Society or where's this book? And it's like, you know, if this really is long term, like, so what? Maybe in 2 more years, maybe they do a Justice Society, or maybe they do whatever character everybody's jonesing for. It's like, it would have been a little ridiculous if they would have tried to do any more books, you know. And I don't know, like, I'm still like, I'm not ready to call it a failure, even though I am like Mitch, where they probably, I jumped on the bandwagon pretty quickly, and then I also realized pretty quickly that I'm like, I don't really want to buy, you know, this many books from them because they're just not, I'm not feeling it. But, you know,
I just respected the hell out of the decision, because obviously they had to do something. And even if it wasn't the right something or didn't whatever, they did something drastic. And that's always been a big thing with me. Like, I like drastic change. I'm kind of a fan of it. And if it doesn't work out, it doesn't work out. If it works out, that's awesome. But, you know, you can always, it's comic books. They can go back to the old one if they want at some point. And it's really not going to bug me. It's just the stories. It's just how it, these creators are making these stories. So if you look at the legacy of a company or just a specific title or a character, that's just how the dice is rolling right now.
Right. Well,
go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, and I agree with the idea of, like, you know, maybe it works, maybe it doesn't, but you're not going to make something great by playing it safe.
Exactly.
You know, so at least take the chance. And for a corporation, you know, to do that is pretty, pretty amazing that they at least took the chance on it. But it, you know, and I think, well, we can get into this discussion a little bit, but, you know, I think we see that so much in so many areas of, like, I think about this all the time. We've gotten things refined down to, like, in entertainment or in, especially in entertainment, though. Like, if you look at music or movies or TV, there used to be a sort of chaos to it. you know, in some ways. Like, there would be, you know, just say, like, a band that would come out of nowhere and just, you know, all of a sudden become huge, and they were a frickin' mess, and they didn't, you know, somebody, you know, threw televisions out of a hotel room, and, you know, people were drug addicts and all, you know, not to say that that was better, but it was, like, it was chaotic, yeah, and it was, yeah, right? But it was chaotic, and it was, in, you know, kind of crazy, and it wasn't, like, this controlled experiment. And now it seems like we've gotten so good at sort of marketing things and preparing, packaging everything and knowing exactly how people are going to react to stuff, you know, like, it's like, okay, here is this, and it's going to sell to this, and it's going to, you know what I mean? Like, there's, you don't see as much of the sort of just crazy fools just throwing the, you know, throwing their balls out there and getting lucky and succeeding, you know, anymore.
That's all, I want to see more balls.
I want to see more balls. But you know what I mean? Like, it's like everything's so calculated now. Like, everything is so, you know, people want to make sure they're successful before they ever try anything, you know, and I get that, but at the same time, it seems like, you know, when are you going to see something just completely crazy and great from that?
Well, I remember when I was young, and you probably, Sal, remember this, but like, when you saw somebody who had like sleeves on their arms, tattoos and stuff, like that meant something.
Now usually they were either a biker or they were in prison, or, you know.
yeah. But like now they could be in a boy band.
Right.
It doesn't matter anymore. Like everything has melted into its everything. You know, like, you know, you could be a pop star, but you wear all these like metal, you know, mohawk or something like that, and just shit just doesn't matter the way, or symbolize the same thing anymore. And I guess on one hand it's progress, but at the same time it sort of becomes
fucking boring,
meaningless, and at the same time. So it's, yeah.
No, This is what
we will sit on a porch and complain about. This is
all right. Are we just becoming old men? Is that what it is?
Get off of my lawn.
Yeah.
Well, no. I have a couple of tattoos, and I've often thought, oh, I'd like to get some more tattoos. But it's almost to the point of like, you know, because everyone just has got sleeves of tattoos. Like, it's not really
unique, is
it? Yeah, it's not very cool anymore to me. Like, it's sort of like, you're all doing it, and it's not that cool anymore. Like, you know, it's funny. I was just thinking about this today of, like, comic books and like, the geek stuff, the geeks culture, the shit that, you know, I grew up getting made fun of is so mainstream now that it's like, I don't even really want to be a part of it to some degree, because it's just, like, that weird, you know, punker sort of mentality of like, well, fuck you. If you like it, it's got to suck, you know, kind of thing.
You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to go get a 40-hour week job with good health insurance. I'm going to show you, man.
Yeah, right. but and everything's become a mashup. You know what I mean? Like, it's just like everything is two parts of this and one part of that. And just put it, and you know, one hand, it's like, oh, that's pretty cool, you know, and then on the other hand, it's like, this is, come up with a fucking idea, you know, like, this isn't an idea, this is a mashup, everything's a mashup, you know, it's like, I don't know, I think it is just like old man syndrome, of just like, you stupid kids, you don't know what you're doing anymore, this is terrible, everything sucks. In the jailhouse, four lips getting speed. I said I need a lawyer. I ran a red light on the street. The bomb can't lead the blind, and baby I'm blind as you. I can't help myself. How can I help you? I need a help. I need a help, girl. I need a help now. I need a help, girl.
You guys talking about all figured out.
It's all good. It's all good with Mitch. How old are you, Mitch?
I'm 30. 30. Almost 31.
Okay, so you're quite a bit younger than I am. And Brent, I don't remember how old you are. You're
I'm 32.
Okay, you guys are both young punks. You're the kids I'm talking about. You're the no.
I think it's just going to be a generational thing. Like, I don't know. Like, everybody's fretting right now about how to make money in the next generation. You know, it's like comic books. You know, there's these, you know, Marvel now. There's the new DC, the new 52. They're just trying to stay afloat while publishing is so bad. You know, and they're just trying to make money. They have sister companies that are, you know, or they have parent companies that are, you know, they have to show a profit to. And I mean, we've been through this. We've been at this cycle for a long time now of like, you know, but I just feel like it's going to be like either my daughter's generation or before that, that it's just like, there's going to be this way that's sort of figured out how to make money at the internet. And I think we're seeing it like with Etsy and all of this stuff. And I think it's just going to be, it's going to be that like mom and pop chain store is no longer on the street. It's online, you know, and, if it's successful enough, it can branch out and be bigger. And I just think that success is just going to have to be gauged differently for a lot of different things. And I think especially with something like comic books and art in general, it's bands and stuff. I mean, I think music is starting to be a little bit ahead of the game of where comic books is about how to get noticed and make money and stuff with the internet. And I just think we got to play catch up with them. And it's going to require like Kickstarter. It's going to become, if you like making comic books, you better like making how to publish them, print them, ship them yourself. You're going to have to learn how to love to be a publisher as well, is what I think it's really going to come down to for a lot of people. And it's tough to do that because, I mean, we did that with, you know, we self-published Horrorwood through Ape Entertainment, and we did a lot of that. And now we're doing it with Astronaut Dad after we got the rights back. And it's like, I love making comic books, man, but like being on top of like sales and all this other stuff, there's a lot of grunt work that's involved. And I'm sure Mitch knows too, through like doing Kickstarter with Johnny Recon, that like I don't like doing all that stuff, but like, no, I mean,
like doing Johnny Recon, both Scott and I realized that like originally the concept was, you know, we were gonna make this comic and we were gonna self-publish it, and then all the money is ours and all the rights are ours, and you know, we don't gotta work. And we quickly learned while putting those two issues out that like you can't do everything at once. Like the reason it took a year for issue two to come out is because we had to market and you know, print the book, get that all ready, get, you know, printing prep and different marketing things, and like it takes up so much time. It's the job of, you know, 3-4 people. And I believe in self-publishing now. Well, the internet's a different thing. If we're just talking paper, I believe self-publishing is an amazing way for you to get noticed to go somewhere else.
Well, I think, you know, I think what people discount a lot of times when you talk about publishers is the fact that there's a reason that they should make a part of the money of some of the success of something, because they do a big chunk of the work. It's not the creative side of it. But there is work that has to be done outside of drawing or writing a comic book for a comic book to sell. And, you know, it's a really good point that you guys bring up of like, you know, self-publishing is great. And yes, you own everything and it's all yours. But yes, you are opening your own business at that point. And it's really difficult to do. There are, you know, now, you know, obviously in the past in comics, the balance was, you know, skewed, and it was way too far in the favor of the publishers. You know, you had creators that had no control and had no ownership and were getting, you know, were getting robbed from their creations and were not being rightfully compensated for their work. But I think sometimes that's created this atmosphere of you know publishers shouldn't get anything.
Damn the man kind of syndrome.
Yeah, and you know, hey, I'm all for that too, but the reality of it is if somebody's doing work so that you can be successful, they should be paid too.
Yes.
It's just, you just got to figure out what that is worth. And you know, I've brought it up before of like, hey, I know that Siegel and Schuster sold, you know, Superman for $500. And Superman went on to make millions and millions and millions of dollars in different, you know, ways. But would Superman had ever been anything more than an idea from two guys from Cleveland if they hadn't have sold it to who they sold it to. You know what I mean? Like, would it have ever had the opportunity to make that kind of money if they had kept it themselves and you know, done whatever they wanted to do with it? Probably not. You know, like, I understand that people want to sit there and look at, you know, Steve Ditko and say, well, he created Spider-Man. Yeah, but he also created a lot of stuff on his own that he did keep and nobody gives a shit about. You know what I mean? Like, nobody cares about Mr. A. I mean, you know, other than, like, Vince on 11 O'Clock Comics. You know, there's, like...
Alan Moore made a lovely song about it. I don't know if you've ever seen that In Search of Steve Ditko documentary, but he sings a song on there about Mr. A. It is amazing.
Like, but you know what I mean? It's like, you know, it's certainly not right that, you know, Spider-Man necessarily went on and made all this money and they didn't get a part of that. But at the same time, it's like, would Spider-Man have been anything if you didn't have...
I think there should be some sort of, like, legacy clause, you know, where you get a percentage. But I definitely don't think, let's use the Superman thing. I definitely don't think the Shuster-Siegel families should be getting the majority of anything.
Right.
They should be getting a small percentage because, you know, it's a business. And they put all that together and... they're the ones who did the legwork and where Superman is now. But I do believe there should be a legacy just for,
you absolutely. Know, the I mean, yeah, the creation but of it. And
I feel
and
it should that, be a pretty small yeah. percentage.
Yeah, there's got to be a happy medium. And I mean, the fact that, like, Jack Kirby's estate has received no money from, especially with all these movies and stuff coming out, I think it's a little bit ridiculous. And, you know, and sad, and it's just sad that, you know, I don't know. I guess that's the one thing too. When I sit here and I see a lot of comic older generation guys in comics too, is that I see them and me and Mitch talk about this a lot. I feel like there's a lot of negativity from a generation that's ahead of us about comics, and I think that they sort of get off on watching this generation sort of in their opinion, I think, kind of fail. And, or if they hear news about Batman or something that they don't like, they always kind of oh, well, this is, you know, just DC bastardizing someone else's character creations. And I don't know if all of it's always justified and stuff like that, but I just hope for me is I've gone to visit a couple creators that I still do respect, but that I've just been really let down by. And just kind of disappointed in meeting them. And I hope I'm never really that guy. And I also hope that, like, if the writing's on the wall that, you know, comic books are not this thing that I'm going to finish my career in, that I'm smart enough to, like, get out or at least, you know, find a way to make other money that so when I do comics, it's just something that I still can enjoy, you know. So, because there's a lot of bitter guys out there that are just scrambling for work because this is all they know how to do. And it just maybe they're... their phone isn't ringing for whatever reason. And, I don't know. It's just kind of a bummer.
Yeah, it definitely is. And I think, you know, sad is definitely the right word for a lot of it is that the, you know, what happened with so many of these guys is sad. And the fact that their lives were not nearly as successful as their creations, mm-hmm. Is a shame, and they were definitely taken advantage of, but you know, there's nobody, you know, there's as far as I know, there's nobody at DC Comics or Marvel Comics who had anything to do with a lot of the, you know what I mean, like those guys weren't involved with it, so to ask for, you know, sort of reparations from these companies now, it seems unfair. It doesn't, it just seems unreasonable in some ways.
Well, I see what you're saying at one point, but at the same time, it's like, I feel like every time you have to call somebody to complain about service, like, I feel like I had this call where I had to call AT&T and kind of complain about service or something like that. And, like, you have to start somewhere. I mean, they're going to throw somebody who's probably making minimum wage at you who's just like, you know, I know you're upset, but I don't know what to tell you. And it's like, if you really, you know, like I said, I think Jack Kirby's estate has deserved some money, and I imagine that, you know, like I said, none of the editors there today have anything to do with what happened.
But that's what I mean. Like, I'm not saying it definitely. I would be absolutely thrilled if DC, you know, Marvel and DC both gave money to Jack Kirby's estate and all the rest of these guys. You know, I mean, I Gene Colan is a guy that I got to know a little bit and really it saddened when he died and the way that his life was and in the end and that kind of thing. I think those guys, I would love if those guys were all taken care of, but my point is more to the fact of, like, the people working in Marvel or DC or those characters, you know, they don't have anything to do with it. They don't have any control of that. They don't, you know what I mean? So to sit and, like, bash guys that are working or, like, attack the company that they're working for or make them feel, which I see all the time, it's just, like, this weird sort of thing that doesn't seem to make any sense. It's like, you know, the Before Watchmen stuff is a perfect example.
Yeah.
You know, I see so many attacks on the guys that are doing those books, and it's like...
I know, it's like scabs. You cross the line.
Right, you know, and it's just like this weird thing of, like, you want creators to get paid and make money and have good lives, but at the same time you don't want them to work on something that you think is beyond reproach or, you know, beyond being touched or isn't, you know, shouldn't be messed with. And it's just like, well, you're not the person to make that decision necessarily. Right. And to blame guys for just doing something that they probably grew up enjoying, you know what I mean? Like, that just seems kind of crazy to sit there and want to hurt other people's careers because they're doing something that you've deemed morally reprehensible.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know where I'm going with that, but that's...
a Michael Jackson concert.
All right. Let's talk a little bit about, Mitch, about your book that you're working on now, The Activity, which I have to admit that I have not read. It's one of the books...
That's it, I'm out of here.
Sorry. but it is something that I do want to read, and I don't know if the first trade is out yet or not, but that's what I've sort of been waiting for. For that trade to come out so I can pick it up, because I like to read trades. I like to read chunks of comics nowadays. But tell us a little bit about that book, how that sort of project came along and where it's headed.
Gotcha. Yeah, the first trade is out. Came out 2 months ago.
Oh, Christ, I'm really behind.
But one day I just got a call. This was... while I was still working on Starborn, and I believe I just started my first Doctor Who thing, and I got a call from this guy, said his name was Nathan Edmondson, who I've never heard of before, and he just started talking to me. He said he was a comic book writer, and he had this idea, and this was at a weird point where for like a month, I had gotten probably 3 or 4 of these calls from just random writers trying to, you know, start something up, then people I have no connection to. And none of them really, like, clicked. It was all kind of, like, either weird ideas that I wasn't too into, or I would look their name up after the phone call and realize, like, they, you know, had next to nothing under their belt, which is a really scary proposition to start a series with someone like that. But Nathan called, and we just kind of clicked personally when we were talking, and then he came with the idea, and the pitch for the idea was basically everything that I'm super into outside of comics. I'm a huge fan of military fiction and nonfiction, you know, military games. Like, the military fascinates me, especially the special forces end of it, because I really do think that these men and women they're superheroes. They're ridiculous. A sniper can learn to change their heart rate so they can get that shot out in the part they want. And, like, I really do feel like this is as close to superheroes as we get in the modern world. And so I've always been into that. And Nathan kind of pitched the idea from the ground up. So he just had an idea. He knew of this organization called the Intelligence Support Activity. And he wanted to do a book with three or four members of the team or of a team, and we kind of just got started talking about it from there. And that was the only idea Nathan had at that point. He's like, I know of this real life, but like as Black Ops as it gets organization. And we just kind of started talking back and forth and came up with characters and ideas and developed it together and developed who they were together. And we just started, you know, getting to that point. And then all of a sudden I had a script and started doing pages. And after, like, you know, we finished that first issue and we both really liked it. And then we started the second one. And originally the impetus of the book was it was going to be more Mission Impossible-y, more, you know, like real life, but with tech that was like just past, you know, what's actually out there, like right. Just slightly like crazy. And as we started doing issue two and Nathan started having these connections, he used to work in Washington and, you know, just living in Georgia. And I know his wife has a gig connected to the military. And so he had kind of some connections and started talking to them. And both of us are big researchers otherwise. And all of a sudden we started realizing that everything we were coming up with, all our ideas for future issues and all our ideas for that issue we were on at that moment, were things that were three, four steps behind in reality. And like we would come up with an idea and all of a sudden we'd have this contact who would send us a picture like, oh yeah, we used to do that 4 years ago in the military. And it like fascinated us. And so Nathan just like really went out there and we got some more advisors and we really got into making this thing as realistic as possible. And that's been our impetus and what we feel our job is right now up through where we are now. And I always say this and I know it comes off as like hype or marketing, but I am somehow I came across my dream book this early in my career. Like this is absolutely 100% everything I would want to do. And it's at an amazing time in comics where I get to do it, where we can do a realistic military book. I mean, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, publisher would have laughed at you.
Right. Like,
there's no market for that.
Right.
Like, and now we're doing it. And I am absolutely loving every minute of it.
Well, you can't ask for more than that. Is it doing well? I mean, I have no idea. I don't really pay attention to sales well, but
sales wise, it could be doing better. I mean, it's not horribly, but you know, it's like all image books. They need, not only do they need readers to go buy it, but they also need pre-orders. So it's, you know, right now we're just kind of doing the book as best we can, getting the word out, and that's kind of all we can hope for. And I take great pride in this book because of the topic and because of the real world implications of it and trying to show people what people are actually doing each day in and out. So I take great pride in finding new readers for the book.
Well, yeah. I'm going to go and pick this up right away because
you better.
I'm also like, I'm a big military guy too. Like I have family members that are military. My dad was in the Korean War. My one cousin was in Airborne Ranger in Vietnam. My other cousin was in Desert Storm. His son is currently a Ranger. He's been to Afghanistan and back, and so I have a huge like respect and interest in military stuff. And my one family member who is, you know, military intelligence, he would often talk about, he wouldn't talk about stuff, you know, he just had that sort of, even when he was out, it was like, you know, it's not something I'm going to talk about, but, you know, he'd always sort of drop hints about, oh yeah, that's kind of cool, but, you know, we had that thing, you know, 5-6 years ago that you see now on the street, we were using it, you know. He's like, if you see something technology-wise being sold to the public, the military's had it for at least 5 years. You know, and it's pretty amazing when you start to kind of are able to get into some of that stuff and find out what the kind of stuff that is really out there. But it leads me to a couple of different places. This the Special Forces stuff, especially. One, have you at all watched that reality show that's been on Stars Earned Stripes?
I am totally obsessed with it.
I am too, and I know you know, I'm sure people you know probably just go, oh, that's just ridiculous. But the one thing I will say about that show that they have done so well is that they make it all about these guys, these military guys that are involved. And if you're not familiar at all with the show, it's basically it's you know like a reality TV show, and you have a bunch of you know former actors and you know kind of your average reality TV show cast. You know, it's Todd Palin and Dean Cain and
Superman's on there.
Yeah,
he better win.
He's doing pretty good. And Terry Crews, but they're teamed up with actual Special Forces guys, Special Force operatives. And the show, I think, does a really good job of sort of going, yeah, this is a television show, it's entertainment, and, you know, they, you know, like any reality show, it's only so real, but
it's a glorified game show, is what I wish they would just market it as, like, a really cool game show.
But they've at least, you know, what I really like about it is that they've done their best to at least project the idea that this is, not only is it a show, but it's an opportunity to sort of show you what these guys do every day.
That's my thing about Stars Earned Stripes, is that on the surface, it's really hard to tell anyone. Like, when I talk to people now, and I'm, like, all excited about it, they just look at me like I'm insane.
Right.
But what's great about that show is the celebrity part of it, even though that's what you'd think. That's, you know, what Stars Earned Stripes, etc. The actual celebrities are, like, the B plot. Like, they're so buried amongst educating about military operations and the different units and what these people are capable of. Like, if you even watch that show, the camera's on the operators more than it is the celebrities.
Yeah, absolutely. And they use every moment that they can to remind us that, you know, this is about these guys have all been there. I mean, this is what they do on a daily basis. This is their jobs. You know, I think every one of the guys, the operatives they have, are combat, you know,
yep,
combat proven guys. And I mean, they have dudes like Chris Kyle, who, you know, is the greatest sniper in the history of the American military. Mm-hmm. And you know, I mean, this dude is, you know, it doesn't get any more real than that. Like, you know, I don't remember. It's like 100 and I think he has 140 confirmed kills, you know, and it's like, if you know anything about being a sniper, like, that's insane. That's crazy. Like you said, superhero-esque, that the guy is like that. And yeah, I'm really glad that I've been able to find someone else that doesn't just snicker at it, because I think, you know, because of the reality TV show aspect of it, it, I think a lot of people just immediately turn their nose up at it.
Your team pick.
My team? I think Dean Cain and Chris Kyle are pretty damn good. I really like Eve Torres. But that may, I don't know if that has anything to do with her competing in the show or not. And Todd Palin is pretty good. You know,
Sarah Palin's husband?
Yes.
Is he in an Arctic cat gear the whole time?
On the show. And, you know, whatever about the Palins, but.
Sure. Yeah.
But, man, that guy. Like, he did his first mission, and he essentially was, like, beating out the operators. Like,
yeah.
He trucked. It was pretty wild to see. Like, even Chris Kyle, the, you know, most confirmed kills sniper in the U.S. military, he's like a little kid watching Todd Palin do all this stuff. He's like, I want to bring Todd Palin to war.
Yeah, absolutely. He's like, this dude's Rambo. This guy is, like, he was a machine. I mean, like you said, I have no love for Sarah Palin, and I don't want to like the guy, but not only was he just, like, unbelievably good at it, but he's also, like he came off extremely generous to the other contestants and just like, you know, modest and just wanted to be like, hey, you know, because it was the first operation was basically they were teamed up with two other, with another celebrity and another operative. And was it Dolvet Quince? Was that who it was that he was teamed up with? Do you remember, Mitch?
Yeah. Wait, no, it wasn't Dolvet.
Or Terry.
It might have been told. I don't remember.
Anyway, it doesn't matter. But like the first thing they had to do was jump out of a helicopter into a you know water and then swim to a boat. And the person just freaked out and couldn't. They have like 70 pounds of gear on, and you know I'd imagine it's pretty terrifying if you're not that good of a swimmer, you know. And so they just like freaked out and they were, you know, basically had to be rescued, and so they couldn't finish the mission. And so Todd had to basically do it by himself, and he, like we were saying, he was unbelievably good at it. But then he was done. He's just like, you know, they're asking him, you know, sort of the post-mission interview kind of thing, and he's just like, oh, I don't care. Let's just make sure that person's okay. You know, the other person, you know, the person that hadn't finished the thing is like, oh, man, he's actually, you know, I don't want to like this guy. He's good at this, and he seems like a really nice guy. Damn it. What is he doing with Sarah Palin? Sorry. That's a little political...
Had to go and be a sweetheart, you son of a bitch.
Yeah, why couldn't you be a real asshole? But no, I'm definitely I'm a huge military guy. And so the other thing I wanted to talk about was you had tweeted today about something that you're doing very soon, which looked awesome and cool. The Navy SEAL sort of training thing that you're doing. Tell me about that, because that
doing it on Friday, which is 2 days from now, but. Or actually, you know, yeah, 2 days. But no, it was part of a you know Groupon deal. Basically, what this company does is it's a former Navy SEAL who heads the company. I think his three other instructors are either former military or they're all former Navy SEALs. But they do this thing called Operation Geronimo training, and basically, it's a 3 to 4 hour thing where people come. And it's like, you know, $400, $300 to do it. And you come, and the first part is just training you on, you know, a couple different weapons and real live fire, just getting you there. And then the middle part is all about teaching you tactics. And then the last part is they have a fake mission set up, which is completely modeled after the mission, the raid to kill Osama bin Laden.
Oh.
And basically, you know, you do all the training, et cetera, and then you get there are simulation rounds, which is, it's paint rounds, but they're in an actual bullet casing. So you fire them from an actual AR-15 or M4, whatever they use.
Right.
Ejects the casing just like a normal gun, et cetera. It just shoots a paint bullet. And, you know, you and your team go through the mission together with what you've learned. And, I called ahead, kind of talked to their PR person there and stuff, and we got the go-ahead to kind of do a little cross-promotion. So I'm going to go there, and when I do it, I'm going to have someone with me who will take a ton of pictures, and I'll take a ton of pictures of them. And eventually, you know, I'm hoping to do like a little two-page feature in the back of an upcoming issue about it, or, you know, I'm sure we'll post it online too. But, you know, it's just, it's all this stuff I love, and just kind of getting that training from the real people, it can only help the book.
No, that sounds like a ton of fun. That's something I would totally want to do that.
That would be super fun. It takes me back to times when, like, when I was a kid, we used to have, I mean, it's not the same, but, like, we used to love go and do paint gun wars and stuff like that when we were younger.
Right.
And you just sort of strategize and stuff like that. And how could you not have fun kind of doing that kind of stuff? But this sounds a little more big boy in real world than capture the flag with your buddies.
What's the name of the company?
It's called SEAL Mindset.
SEAL Mindset?
Sealed, so SEALED Mindset.
I might have to go up to Minnesota and check that out.
Come see the White Sox this next week. We can go do it.
They're coming up to play the hated Twins, although the Twins aren't that hated this year because they're freaking awful.
Yeah, they're terrible. But yeah. It's fine with that.
Yeah, I got no problem with it.
You guys.
Yeah. What?
So you guys suck.
Are you a Twins fan, Mitch?
I'm a Twins fan, but not like a diehard where I'll defend them on a podcast type thing.
Sorry. I really enjoy. Well, I went up. Was it 2 years ago? We went. Yeah, I came up and we saw the Sox because it was great sitting in the new stadium surrounded by Twins fans, but me and you just sitting there and ripping on Joe Mauer and the Twins is I think, did we see a, I don't remember the Sox won that game or not.
Yeah, they did. They crushed
they did, it. They did, yeah.
George Beckham hit one that hasn't even landed yet. So.
His last one, probably.
Probably.
Well, you know, it's funny. I was going to mention, you were talking about paintball stuff. When I was a kid, I had this big group of friends, and yeah, we did that kind of thing. But we lived not very far from us was a deserted military base that had like missile silos and lots of buildings and desks, and like they just left a bunch of shit there. But it was abandoned. Now it's all been wiped out and leveled. But we would go there and play military games with paintballs and stuff like that, and it was awesome. It was the greatest place ever to do that as a kid, but now they've tore it all down. No more fun. No, that sounds, are you a gun guy at all, Mitch? I mean, I know, I'd imagine with the book, you've probably done lots of research, but do you shoot guns?
I don't own an actual gun. I own 3 or 4 airsoft guns now for reference for the book. So you'll often see me wandering through my house in the dead of night with a laser sight looking all cool by myself.
Nice. Well,
I mean, I go out and I've shot guns with, and my brother has a little collection. We'll go shoot there and, other various little things. I would like to actually own one. It's fun target shooting and stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I have a couple, and I have friends with lots of guns, and it's better to have friends with lots of guns because it's just as convenient generally to go shooting with their guns, and you don't have to have them. I mean, I got kids, so it's like I still have my guns, but I don't think my children even know they exist.
And that's the best gun owner though. Like
It's like I don't they've never seen them. I don't believe that either one of them know that I even have them. And they're locked away because it's not like, I don't have them for like home protection and that kind of thing. It's just, like you said, target shooting, that kind of thing. I'm not a hunter. I don't want to hunt, but,
yeah. My dad is a, me and my brother got out of the house, my parents started taking up, like time period camping. Like they don't do Civil War reenactment kind of stuff, but like they go and they like only camp with the equipment of a certain era.
Really?
And they do like French Indian War era camping, and they treat themselves as like Dutch colonial people, and like they shoot guns. My dad is a huge, like when I was a kid, when we moved into the house that I grew up in, there was 2 refrigerators down in the basement that they asked if they wanted them to get taken out before they moved in. My dad said no. And he converted them into like gun racks, and he put a lock on them. I mean, my dad's always had probably 25 to 35 guns at any given time in their house. And we would go out to the gun club, and he would shoot competition, and I would help pick up bullet casings. And when I went home 2 months ago, a month and a half ago, for a shindig, we went out and shot his 18th century muzzle loader out of the competition for him. And, it was funny. They had like these pulleys that had like fake deer. So it was like, you had to shoot a moving target, and, it's fun. I've always enjoyed going out with my dad and shooting and stuff. He's gone out and shot deer before for deer season, but I took the class and it just was like, that was the important thing. My dad always said is if you're going to go hunt, you have to, you have to gut it and you have to kill it and you have to do everything, if you're going to eat it. And, it just wasn't my thing. I watched the video on all that and I'm like, I'm good. So, my brother did, but, It just wasn't really my thing. But we've always had guns in our family, and I've always enjoyed shooting them. And it's a fun thing to do, like just kind of get out of the house. And, you know, it's funny because I kind of relate it to it. Kind of helps retrain my eye with, like, you know, kind of eyeing up stuff like that. And I actually do a bunch of ammo targets for a company in town, and a lot of them now, because the zombies are so popular, I do a bunch of like zombie ammo targets. Like,
nice.
Just today I was drawing a zombie pirate. So
very cool. Oh yeah, man, if you get any extras, you got to send me some of those.
Oh, that's, dude, I've got a ton. I will gladly send
some. I'll take some.
I have so many. It's ridiculous. And they're all movie poster size, so it's like,
oh, awesome.
They take like I've got hundreds in my house, and I'm like, I need to get rid of these, because like,
send them to me, dude. I'll get rid of them. Yeah, you know, it's such a weird thing. Like, you know, I've owned guns since you know, basically my 20s, and my dad was a gun owner, and you know, and you know, obviously with recent events, of course, it's such a hot topic with guns and everything. And you know, for me, you know, I understand there's people that don't want guns and anything, and I'm not going to pretend like I have any answers. You know what I mean? Like, I don't fucking know. I don't know what the answer is. I don't know if you take all the guns off the street, if it's better. I don't know if you give everybody guns, if it's better. I have no freaking answers whatsoever. But I did have an idea of, like, I think there's a lot of people like me that I don't necessarily have to own a gun, but I really like going out and shooting guns. And if you gave me the opportunity to turn in my guns for like a lifetime of being able to go to a range anytime and shoot it, mm-hmm. I'd be fine with that. I don't need to have it in my house. I just want to be able to go and shoot my gun. You know what I mean? It's like, hey, I'll trade in all my guns and you let me rent a 50 cal once a month, you know, that kind of thing. You know, it's because that's all I really want to do. I watch Stars and Stripes and I see those guys with some amazing weaponry, and it's just like, oh, I just want to fire that thing a couple of times. You know, give me an hour and I'm good. I don't need to have it in my house. I don't need an assault rifle. I have no use for an assault rifle other than every once in a while I'd take it to a range and have a blast with it. Cause I'll tell you what, I've fired automatic weapons. I've fired assault rifles. I've fired Tommy guns, and they're fucking fun, but I don't need to have one. You know, the only reason I would want one is because they're fun, but you know,
we had a bachelor party up here, and a friend of mine wanted to go shoot a Tommy gun for his bachelor party, and so we went to a gun range, and the only thing they had for us to shoot with a Tommy gun that was, like, for some reason, was a bunch of, like, stuffed animals, so they'd hang us, and then you'd shoot it, and I just felt like, it's the weirdest thing ever, but it was fun to shoot. I just felt odd shooting it. Teddy bear.
Yeah, that's a little twisted.
Yeah.
Alright, that's probably enough gun talk for today. Yeah.
I should probably actually wrap it up here soon. I hate to cut out, but
no, that's fine. We've been going a long ways, so
we've solved every problem.
Well, that's what we do on this podcast. I generally, you know, we usually solve the world's problems. And well, you know, it was a lot of fun, guys. I had a blast. Thanks so much for coming on, both of you. And I hope it won't be the last time you guys come on Around Comics. You're more than welcome to come on anytime. Yep. And hopefully sometime I'll get up to Minnesota again, because I really enjoyed visiting the last time. It was a lot of fun.
Right on.
Before we take off, anything you guys want to, you know, plug or promote, or any websites or anything you want to send people to? Feel free if you guys have anything to plug on it. Yes, no?
Can you guys actually hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. For a while there, I was saying stuff. It wasn't going through. But I guess I've got the Doctor Who 2012 special from IDW, which is out next week. And then the activity number 8 is out in a couple weeks, I believe. But yeah, I just kind of want to stress, you know, if the activity is something you dig, or just from listening to this podcast, something you might dig, I just want to stress, you know, how important it is to pre-order, or just go to your shop and let your store owner know how much you want this book, and hopefully I'll be on it for a long time.
Well, I'm going to pick it up. I'm going to get the trade and get it, and maybe I'll... Is it available digitally?
Yep. It's on Comixology.
Maybe I'll do that instead. Well, awesome, man. I hope you have great success with it. Like I said, I've been a fan for a long time, so it's cool to see you, you know, doing bigger and better stuff, and I hope that book's along on for a long time, and I hope you do other stuff too. And tell Nathan to come on the show. I contacted him a while back about coming on, but I think we had some scheduling issues. Because I'd like to talk to him too. I'm a fan of his work.
And, yeah, we'll both come on.
Yeah, that'd be great. Absolutely, anytime. You guys are welcome. Brent, anything you want to tell people about? Oh, I think we lost. Did we lose him? Did he just leave?
He just texted me and said he thinks he cut out.
Oh, all right. Well, I don't think he's working on anything anyway, so he gets no plugs.
No, I don't. As far as comics go, he doesn't have anything.
All right. Well, thanks everyone for listening. You can reach us at aroundcomics.com. You can email us at info@aroundcomics.com. You can tweet us at Around Comics, and we'll be back again next week. I think Braxton and I are going to be doing another show next week, something not before Watchmen related, because that seems to be all we've been doing lately. But anyway, I'd like to thank both Mitch and Brent for joining us tonight, and it was a lot of fun. And thank you all for listening. Have a good night. Adios, motherfuckers.
Let him look at your tits. You're an artist.